From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A new series on Discovery Channel is part competition, part history lesson, and part indulgence of a cultural fascination with weaponry. Skilled craftsmen are assigned to build traditional weapons, battle axes, swords, and the like, and the winner walks away with $10,000 and the title Master of Arms.
I build historical weapons with historical tools and technology, so I'm going to win this.
I want to try it. This is showing who I am. This is what I do, and I'm going to do whatever I can at this point to win.
The money would be awesome, but I want to prove that I'm among the best.
The weapons are field-tested by a former Special Forces soldier and judged by a panel including Georgia native Trenton Tye. Trenton is a medieval combat-trained blacksmith who runs a professional blacksmith shop in southwest Georgia. And Trenton, thank you for joining us.
I cannot tell you how much I am geeking out right now because GPB has been a part of my life forever, and to finally be on here, I'm more excited about this than I was about being on the Discovery Channel.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to hear that. So how'd I do with that overview? Anything you want to add to the synopsis of Master of Arms?
You know, the medieval combat trained blacksmith portion, God bless those people over there. A lot of folks don't really realize what we do, so they grasp for descriptions. It is true. I have played in the medieval reenactment anything, but a medieval combat trained blacksmith, that just sounds a little...
It sounded pretty juicy to me, actually.
You know, the things we do for show business, huh?
Well, right. Well, the competitors in the show, they make medieval weapons and early firearms, and we learn their historical context. But it's so funny to me, Trenton. I mean, in this age we have precision weaponry, drone warfare, why are we still so captivated by these ancient weapons?
Well, and one thing that kind of, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit later, one thing that just kind of drives me nuts is the fact that, you know, these are people that are using their hands to build these things. Forget that they are weapons on that end of it. We just, as humans, tend to be very good at making those. But the fact is, these guys are going out there and in the space of a few hours building things that, you know, most people can't figure out how to knit a pair of socks. Mm-hmm. And these guys are making these incredibly complicated items that actually perform as intended.
So was that the hook for you? Did you get interested in making weaponry, or were you a blacksmith first?
I grew up in Lee County, Georgia, on the Mill Pond Plantation, and I don't think that any young man that's ever been out in the woods that picked up a stick didn't start swinging it like a sword. I mean, it's almost genetic at this point. You know, when I started, you know, I came up in the early 80s with, you know, when... You know, the medieval thing was kind of getting steam, and you see Conan the Barbarian and that terrible, terrible image of them actually casting a sword into the snow, which was absolutely ridiculous. But just the mythos around, you know, the big guy with the sword was awesome, and it basically touched an entire generation. So that's where I kind of jumped on board.
So you started blacksmithing then?
The first time, and this is a pretty cool story, I was 7 years old, and we didn't have a lot of books in South Georgia, but we had a lot of diesel. So they took us to a lot of field trips, right? And we went to a place called Andersonville, Georgia, which is the Civil War, and the National POW Museum is there. And there was a guy that was demonstrating blacksmithing there. His name was J. Pennamore Reichert, and I was fascinated by what he did. And many years later, I would find this man again, the very man I first saw do the work, and he became my master in the craft.
Huh. Wow. So did you start making weapons immediately like that boy that you were?
The first time I ever made it was November morning. A fellow named Danny Minnick was a farrier, and he came out and he said, "Hey, you want to play on the forge?" I'm like, "Oh, blah, 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 of course." And I said, and he put a piece of metal in the fire, and I said, "What I make?" He says, "I don't know, just make something." And so I beat on it a little bit, and I got some epoxy putty. I made a handle. I made my first little knife that looked like an Arabian scimitar. It was terrible. But it was my first piece.
Well, that's part of the thing of this show, though, that the set, these glowing forges and molten metal, fires always burning. There's a kind of inherent drama to that. Do you feel, when you were doing this, part of this, I guess, kind of ancient pursuit?
You know, let me tell you, if you are able to look at one of those fires and see metal do what it does and you are not moved, save your preacher the time, you have no soul. It's just... something that is in us. I mean, fire was the original tool. So again, there is something so deeply primal that when we stare at it, I mean, it speaks to us. So I really don't think we have a choice.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the show. The three contestants in the first episode, they all have this challenge of making a battle axe, and then they get judged on that, and then in the next phase, transforming the axe into a pistol. Here's just a clip from the episode.
These are long days. These are tiring days. There's a lot at stake here, and it's not just $10,000. This is a reputation of whoever is working on this project.
So how do you all find people who have these kind of skills, you know, turning an axe into a pistol? Is there kind of an underground of blacksmithing that the rest of us just don't know about?
It's huge. To give you an idea of what the effect that a lot of these shows have had, about 5 years ago, if you were looking for an antique anvil, you pay about $2 a pound, mm-hmm. right? Now it's over $6 or $7 for used stuff. Like literally, the used stuff is more expensive than the ones you can buy new. I mean, that type of impact, and there's a huge following, and obviously because these shows are becoming more and more popular. So they're out there. And the gentleman in that clip is a guy named Dustin, and I love Dustin. He's actually an alumnus from Forge and Fire, and he is a complete showboat. And you know, but there's this super subculture of people that can do the work, and then people that look good on TV. And Dustin is look here. Dustin had the water bottle pouring it over himself like Flashdance. It was hilarious.
And Dustin, he was the one with all the tattoos, right?
Correct.
Not the okay, because there was a sort of tall, I'm going to say, nerdy looking dude
who was Eric.
He was so sweet, but also he's like a Civil War reenactor or a battle reenactor.
No. Oh, Eric comes and look here. Dustin drew a bear, and this is the other thing that we just can't pack into 44 minutes. Eric's actually a gunsmith at Colonial Williamsburg. Of anybody that Dustin could have drawn to go against, this was not the guy. But both of them did such an incredible job. You're mind's blown about what they can do.
Well, that was quite a challenge. Any other notable weapons stumpers for the contestants on the show?
You know, being able, even the Kentucky long rifle that we did, you know, we're doing some things that are really out of the norm. You know, there's a lot of reenactors out there, and you're familiar with a rifle bayonet, but a Kentucky rifle didn't have that. So just from a technical point of view, we're asking these people to put some weird things together, and that's where just the raw ingenuity comes in. So you can be great at the historical end of it, but then there's this little thing extra. So,
well, all right, so it's not just guns, but this medieval weapons. This is really big stuff in video games. I'm thinking of Assassin's Creed, Kingdom Come, Mountain Blade. These are games that have been criticized for desensitizing players to violence, even encouraging it among young players. Any criticism for playing into that on this series?
Man, you know, and here's the thing, this should have been a question lined up beforehand because, you know, I am a historical blacksmith. I'm a reenactor. I am a gamer. I cut my teeth on the Commodore 64. My Mario Kart is so strong, nobody has a prayer. You know, I come from the old days, and we have grown up with this. We came up with Dungeons and Dragons. You know, if you think that Game of Thrones is popular and it has nothing to do with Dungeons and Dragons, there's a problem there. We call that a glass pipe fallacy because you can only believe that if you're smoking crack. This is part of our culture. It's part of the nerd culture. As big as I am, I came from the debate team. I was not on the football team. This is where we come from. This has been in our DNA, and they talk about, you know, we being desensitized. You know, I can tell you that I know a lot about medieval weaponry. I have not yet gone on a rampage in a suit of armor and a sword on a horseback, you know, and don't plan to in the future. So I think that with the video game thing, that it's a lot of opportunistic politicians taking aim at something that sounds really good but has no merit.
I'm speaking with Trenton Tai. He's a Georgia native and a judge on Discovery's Master of Arms. The show airs Friday nights at 10. Well, Trent, we know that a lot of reality TV isn't quite reality. Much of it is scripted or, let's say, arranged to gin up the gossip and the competition and the stakes. How about on your show? How much is scripted?
There's been a real problem they've had. Again, having come, you know, being a part of Forge and Fire, there's a real problem. And I'm going to tell you that I came into this with a chip on my shoulder, but because I cannot tell you how much I have come to loathe the idea of reality TV. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. And there are plenty of shows that the idea is they're using the format from way back in the day. you know, get these people in there that are so desperate to be on TV because they have no other skills in life and make them fight. Make them, you know, do some interesting things and cut each other's throat. That's not how it works with craftsmen. I'm going to tell you that there was a particular moment where they gave up with us craftsmen, because as craftsmen, you don't learn anything if you're ugly to everybody else. You know, when you go in, and even if you don't like these guys, they have the abilities that you want. So if you will shut your mouth, respect their position and their knowledge, you may learn something. And that's almost universal. The comment that was made, and this was very funny because one of the crew on when I was on Forged in Fire was saying, you know, they're just giving up trying to make you guys fight, because the comment was it was like they're all long-lost brothers. And that's how it is. I mean, they were fighting to get us to fight, and we're like, well no, we're not going to say anything ugly about them. Did you see what this guy can do? So, and I'm going to tell you that this particular production company, which is Matador, and our showrunner, Brian Nichelle, as big as a chip of shoulders I had on, they have been wonderful. They treated us as judges incredibly, and we got to treat the craftsmen with the respect that they absolutely deserve. You know, running somebody off the show on a rail doesn't happen. You know, we get to showcase what these guys do, because even the first man out, he can do more than anybody else on that studio, and even if he's the first guy out. Mm. So, you know, it's stunning the respect and the camaraderie that these guys show. And in Master of Arms, you get to see a lot of that.
So you're a little more British baking show than, let's say, Real Housewives of Atlanta, is what
exactly.
I'm hearing.
You know, but it's different for them. We're having to very slowly massage them to this idea that sometimes people like to see the camaraderie and the craft more than the drama.
Okay, so one of the things we like to see is your look, which is a little steampunk. It's a little eccentric. You know, you've got these tiny wireframe glasses and a top hat with feathers. What's the story on the hat?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so Victorian Christmas in Thomasville, Georgia happens every year. Uh-huh. And I travel and I do blacksmithing demonstrations. I was the smith at the Georgia Renaissance Festival for years. I've been the blacksmith at Stone Mountain. I've even been flown to Los Angeles and San Francisco to perform as a smith. But Victorian Christmas is close to home, and I love going down there with all those folks. And, of course, it's Victorian. Now, everybody keeps saying it's steampunk, but the fact is steampunk is late Victorian.
Came from Victorian, right.
So this was my get-up for down there. And we have a big YouTube channel that we've been filming on for 12 years, and I happened to put that Dad Blame hat on, and the folks loved it, right? So for special occasions, I would put this on. I demonstrated the Perry National Fair, so I put that outfit on. And so we get the opportunity to go do this show, and, man, I'm hyped up. You know, man, I get to actually go be on national television. And I said, okay, what wardrobe options do I need to bring? And the lady goes, well, you've got your outfit, right? And I'm like, please don't make me wear that on national television. So it is this double-edged sword. There are so many people that have called and said how much they love the particular outfit, and it is garish, it is gaudy, it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever put on, but it has become almost an icon, and it has been, you know, the good thing is that for better or worse, there's no doubt who sticks out.
Well, Trent and Ty, you really do stick out, and I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ms. Prescott.
A real pleasure. Trent Ty, Georgia native and judge on Discovery's Masters of Arms. You can catch it Friday nights at 10 on Discovery. We should note the program does depict trained professionals building and testing weapons. Probably best not to try these things at home. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're feeling lonely, you are not alone. A Cigna survey found that more than half of Americans report feeling lonely. Public health officials cite research linking social isolation to severe health consequences and reductions in lifespan similar to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Julia Bainbridge digs below those numbers for how people experience this aspect of the human condition in the Lonely Hour podcast.
All right, here's the big one. What does loneliness mean to you?
I don't know.
That is a great question.
Well,
loneliness.
We are digging into the experience of loneliness at a time which can feel especially acute around the holidays with Julia Bainbridge. She's James Beard Award nominated food writer for Bon Appetit and Atlanta Magazine and the host and creator of the Lonely Hour podcast. Hello, Julia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine and curious about this because, you know, loneliness is something that people steer clear of. Why take it on as a topic for a podcast?
Yeah, I mean, as you cited, millions of people are suffering from social disconnection, right? And that increasing disconnection is really what inspired the show. Like, I observed the ways in which technology is distancing us from one another. I saw more and more people freelancing or otherwise working alone in this like gig economy. I learned that more people are living alone and aging alone than ever before. And I watched friends and frankly, even myself growing increasingly disappointed with the kind of video gamification of dating through apps like Tinder. So I wanted to explore what all that looked like. So that was kind of the catalyst, but the approach, which I know we'll get into, but it's to catalog people's experiences with loneliness so that we get more comfortable with it, right? Like there's this taboo around loneliness, and yet it's something we all feel sometimes. So my show aims to demonstrate how much loneliness exists in all of us. It's part of the mixed bag of emotions involved in the human experience.
Yeah, so into season two already, you talked about your own loneliness, which is prevalent in contemporary society statistically, but there was some kind of hesitation in admitting that. What have those conversations you've had with people revealed about that really shame about loneliness to you?
It's funny that I was hesitant to talk about my own loneliness and I'm the girl with the show on loneliness. I think that maybe that says something. That may have had more to do with my wanting this to be a show about other people. And while I have like very little kind of shame about talking my own life and revealing all of my struggles for some reason, it wasn't the Julia show, right? Like this was a show about this topic, but it was funny that sort of tearful conversation I had with my producers when they pushed me to insert myself into the show a little bit. So, you know, I'm still unpacking that, but that's a worthwhile thing to share that may reveal certainly how deep rooted this taboo is. But, you know, through the conversations I've had with guests, I think what I knew to be true about loneliness has just been underscored. Like it's something that exists in all of us and yet there's this taboo. And I learn a lot from my guests, but I also learn a lot from the reading I do around this topic. So here's an idea that might interest you as far as how to explain the taboo. There's John Cacioppo, who was the director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Chicago. He unfortunately passed away last year, but he had been studying the effects and causes of loneliness for over two decades. And he believed that loneliness, which he also calls social pain, is a kind of alarm signal. Like it's nature's way of telling us to rejoin the group lest we compromise our health, which Cacioppo showed is linked to feeling part of a society. So in a way, the stigma against loneliness has value. Like our discomfort with solitary life is a survival instinct.
Right. So if you're the lone antelope outside of the herd, you better get back in there or you're not going to make it.
Exactly. But, you know, what? As far as what I've learned based on the Lonely Hour listener feedback is that talking about loneliness or hearing others talk about loneliness, which is, you know, why I wanted to do this on a audio platform, makes people feel less lonely. So, you know, someone recently wrote to me that it's intensely comforting to know that I'm not alone in my loneliness. So that's what inspires me to keep making this show.
You spoke with a woman named Aimé Lutkin. She wrote an article for Jezebel, "When Can I Say I'll Be Alone Forever?" And that got an awful lot of attention. What does she mean by that question?
Yeah, that was a brilliant article. And, you know, she meant that, I think what she meant is that there's no acceptable language around what she was going through at that time, right? Like she's someone who, at the time of writing the piece, hadn't dated or had sex for years, and she was beginning to wrap her mind around the possibility that that just might be how life is going to look for her from here on out. Like, but she feels like she's not allowed to talk about that, which, as she wrote, makes it a hell of a lot harder to live with. Like, you know, when she tries to tell a friend that she thinks she'll be alone forever, which, by the way, isn't something she cries herself to sleep at night over, they imagine bleakness. They want it to stop. And that's because it's so deeply embedded in our society to fix our lives around partnership and children, you know.
And this is something that people feel acutely around the holidays. In fact, Aimé talked with you about facing New Year's Eve alone again.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I've had the resolution many times in the past few years to be like, okay, this is the year I'm going to start dating. I'm going to put myself out there. I'm going to try harder because I haven't been making space for this. But I realize, you know, I have not made good on any of those promises to myself, and I'm not sure why. But I've reached a point where I can no longer act like something deeper isn't going on.
You dive into the deeper going on for Aimé, but let's look at the holidays for a second, which are approaching. And a single friend of mine calls the holidays the Bermuda Triangle of loneliness, you know, something you have talked about with your guests. And I don't by any means want to say that only single people experience loneliness, but tell me about some of the things that you heard from guests about just that experience of loneliness, especially when everybody else is around feeling joyful, feeling seemingly jubilant, at least that's how it looks on the outside.
Right. I mean, it's IRL Instagram, right? Like, it's sort of like, this is what we talk about when we talk about social media, and you scroll through all these photos of people looking happy and fabulous. You know, that becomes 3D around the holidays when you've got, you know, the city's all dressed up in lights, and there are a million parties. And I think sometimes that can be overwhelming and can make you feel alone. But, you know, also when we talk about the holidays, like, I talked to a family therapist named Courtney Schifrin, and, you know, family can be maddening, right? So, like, even if you're not actually alone and you have a big family and you're home for the holidays, like, there's some self-preservation, I think, that she would recommend shutting the door sometimes to let you recharge, right? And that to prepare you to face the stress that can come with those big family gatherings, I think, for a lot of us.
That's something that I saw over and over again, this kind of experience between being alone, you know, by seemingly feeling like you're forced to be alone because nobody is connecting with you or you're not connecting with them, and the need for contemplation, reflection, time alone. Here is one of your guests, Stephen Satterfield, defining what loneliness means to him.
Loneliness is just a bit more sad than being alone. But it's also something that we've all felt before. But when we're able to identify these gloomy feelings and to grow around them and move beyond them, then there's a new kind of power that we imbue and that we embody because we've persevered, we've grown, we've evolved.
That's Stephen Satterfield speaking on the Lonely Hour podcast. My guest is the host and creator of that podcast, Julia Bainbridge. Julia, Stephen's suggesting that, you know, sitting with the feelings, this is what we're told, right? That's the key. Yet we live in this era when we have a sense of connection at our fingertips with social media. But a lot of research is telling us that that can feel even more isolating, or we can feel depressed because our lives look less than Instagrammable. And you talk with Patrick Janelle, who has a robust social media following, about this. He admits that it's kind of an addiction for him. How does he keep that in perspective?
Yeah, he's a hard case because for Patrick, this is a job, right? Like, he makes a living through Instagram, so the stakes are pretty high. The public approval, you know, followers and brands wanting to work with him because of those followers drives his finances. So he spends a lot of time thinking about and measuring through metrics that public approval, and that can have a detrimental effect, I think, on his psyche and his self-esteem. But so for Patrick, maybe, again, those stakes are higher because this is how he makes a living, but that's something that we can all identify with, right? Like, that seeking that public approval through likes and whatnot. I want to go back. God, first of all, can we just, like, give a shout out to Stephen Satterfield's voice and how beautiful and deep it is. But I want to, you know, something that he was getting to there is the distinction between loneliness and solitude, right? Like, the way I think about it, and this is something that comes up often as I talk about this show and with my guests too, so I guess I just want to get it out of the way. Like, the way I think about it, the aloneness is a state, right? The state of being alone. And loneliness is a negative feeling, a sad feeling over that state. And then there's solitude, which I see as having a more positive connotation. Like, people seek solitude. It can be a recharging time, right? And I think the key here is that, like, both loneliness and solitude are mental things, right? They have to do with perception. Loneliness is perceived isolation. So going back to Cacioppo's work, according to him, loneliness refers to the perception that one's social relationships are inadequate in light of one's preferences for social involvement. So introverts, interestingly enough, in his studies, show none of the health risk factors that married persons with perceived isolation showed. Isn't that kind of fascinating?
Well, there are people that you speak to. Well, let me just make clear that you explore feelings of isolation and motherhood, you know, the guilt of not feeling absolutely joyful and grateful every minute for being a mom, being the only person of color in the office, dining alone, traveling alone. And what I hear is that very human tendency to perceive ourselves as different from other shiny, happy people around us or compare ourselves. That creates separateness. So we are, in a way, perceiving something that isn't necessarily true, or do we just project that it's true because everybody looks so happy?
Right. I mean, yeah, I'm not myself a therapist, but one conclusion I've come to in life is that kind of we're all the walking wounded, right? And we're all deeply insecure, and that insecurity's the root of all evil, as far as I'm concerned, including the tendency to compare ourselves to others and arrive at false conclusions. I think that less than is something we tend to feed ourselves. And Instagram, I guess, you know, getting back to the social media conversation, has allowed us to mainline that stuff. So, you know.
Well, you spoke to Michael Finkel. He is a writer who covered the case of this just fascinating hermit. He dropped out of life. Christopher Knight was 20 when he left his car at a campground in central Maine, and he spent 27 years in the woods. He was called the North Pond Hermit. We used to read about him back in when I was living in New England. So you thought that maybe he had, I don't know, a screw loose, did he?
No, I mean... Once he was captured, I guess you would call it, he went through a bunch of testing, both physical and mental, and he was, for all intents and purposes, a normal guy. Very unusual, but nothing, quote unquote, wrong with him.
Michael got to speak with Christopher Knight, and like many hermits throughout history who've written about the razor-thin line between extreme suffering and extreme joy, he found that in his conversation with Christopher Knight. Here's what he said.
And he said there were these moments where, I think he described the earth as like hard frozen, the forest is completely locked in Arctic silence. There's not even a bird or a whisper of wind, and he's sitting there in his tent, and it's very cold, and it's like there's this silence. And what he said to me was, even more than silence, what he liked was, as he said, stillness. And he said, there's something profound about the stillness of the middle of winter, where you could literally hear your own heartbeat. And he would lay in his tent, halfway suffering and halfway ecstatic. And the way he described that to me, I couldn't really get my head around how someone could do that, but it was clearly this sort of mystical state that he reached, and it stays with me. It stays with me always.
What do you think, Julia? Do some people just not feel lonely?
I mean, some less than others, I think. Christopher is an extreme example of someone who just seems numb to it, almost unhappy when in society, or maybe he's in denial. I mean, either way, he survived out there and most of us wouldn't. But it makes me think of Randall Reeves from the very first episode. He's a single-hander, which means he goes on long sails alone. And by long, I mean like circumnavigating both the Americas and the Antarctic, right? Like these are extreme also. And he says that the times that he's out to sea are times when he feels really connected to the boat, connected to the ocean, connected to the albatrosses that fly close. So he's just built to enjoy that one-on-one connection to nature in a way that not everyone is. Plenty of people would get really lonely out there, but he doesn't.
How does it feel for you, somebody who I'm guessing a lot of people have listened to and turned to, and it has helped them feel more connected to others? So what is your role here?
I got to keep making the show. I mean, I think it's interesting, though, you know, like I'm not... My role is to be a shepherd of this conversation, but I'm wary to call myself an expert. I have maybe some more expertise than others because I spend a lot of time talking to people about this and reading about this topic. But I do have some people coming to me because I've identified myself as a safe haven. I think when you attach yourself to this topic, who come to me in very compromised states looking for help. And I have learned that I have to put up some boundaries. And, you know, I do the best I can to direct them to resources that might help them, but I'm not a therapist, right? So I think my role is to continue to talk about loneliness because we don't see it talked about a lot, and certainly not in kind of, I think, the nuanced way that the show does. I mean, this topic is gaining traction because a lot of people are saying that we're facing this loneliness epidemic. But a lot of the articles I read are about, you know, seven ways to combat loneliness. And I think I'm not necessarily trying to put it in the problem box. I mean, not to sound too zen, but I'm coming from a place of acceptance that this is a part of, this is something that we all feel sometimes. And again, that's why it's so important to neutralize the taboo around it, because we are all connected to loneliness.
Julia Bainbridge, James Beard Award-nominated food writer for Bon Appetit. She is also host and creator of the Lonely Hour podcast. Stay with us. There's more on Second Thought coming up after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia's population grew by nearly 116,000 in 2017, and that is the sixth biggest jump among all U.S. states. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Well, many moved to Georgia for jobs and the state's strong economy, but some additions to Georgia's 10 million total residents were born here, left, and then returned. Some even returned to their hometowns. Well, we wanted to know why people return and what it feels like to come back. So if you've had a Georgia homecoming, please let us know, and we might feature your story. But for today, we're talking with Tito Stone of Covington. He's an indie rock musician turned restaurateur, and he joins me on the line from his hometown, where he runs City Pharmacy. Tito, welcome.
Hey, Virginia.
Well, what was it like growing up there in Covington?
It was your typical small town vibe. You know, a lot of bike riding, baseball playing. But the square here was completely different than it is now. A lot of vacant spaces. It's just really turned around in the last 8 years. But I think it was your typical small town.
Did you have that typical small town feeling of like, as soon as I can, I'm getting out of here?
Yeah. So that was kind of the talk amongst very close to my cousins growing up who lived here. And everybody said growing up, we're never coming back. Once we get out, we're going to go to college. And they all stayed true to that for the most part. But I found myself moving back about 3 years ago. So.
Well, we'd love to hear more about that story. But after high school, you went and studied at University of Mississippi. After college, you got into the Atlanta and Athens music scene. So what was that like?
It was fun. So when I moved back from Oxford, Mississippi, I was introduced to a couple of Athens musicians, and I ended up living in a van for the better part of 3-4 years, and was working part-time with a family business here, but we would go as far north as New York, and we would go, I guess, as far west as Austin, and everywhere in between. So got to see a lot of the country, got that wanderlust out of my system for the most part, at least the part where you're living in a van and sleeping on floors.
Yeah, that can grow old fairly quickly. Here's one of your songs. It is called OTW, and it's from your album Summer Sun. Let's just hear a little clip.
All right.
Right back where it started. Back where I come from.
Well, Tito, it sounds like that song was made for this segment. What were you thinking about when you wrote it?
No, it was perfect, right? That song was off of my new record. I put it out in May, but was writing and recording that in Athens right before my first son was born. and we had just moved back to Covington, and I think that a lot of that was kind of felt throughout the album, and as you can hear specifically on that one, just having traveled and been away more than I'd been home, even when I'd moved back to Atlanta, just feeling like it was time to settle down. That's exactly what was happening in my life, was having children. And so, yeah, that album was written kind of in this transitional period where we were in the process of moving back to Covington.
Yeah, and you met your wife in Atlanta, I think at one of your shows, right?
I did, yes. So I was playing out in Atlanta. We had gone to the same high school, but didn't really know each other. We're a couple of years apart and reconnected. She pulled a stool up in front of me. I told her how nervous I was to be playing that night because I was playing by myself, and I'm usually with a loud band behind me. And she pulled up a stool, and we just, the rest is history. Two babies in a restaurant.
Well, let's get to that restaurant, because, you know, after your time moving around big cities and playing all over the place, did you ever imagine yourself moving back to Covington?
You know, all my family's here, so I think part of that, I could see myself coming back. But it wasn't until around that time, you know, when I was looking to settle down, and every time I would come back to Covington and visit, even when I was out in Mississippi, it started to look more like Oxford, Mississippi, which I don't know if you've ever been there.
I have.
Restaurants popping up and the
coffee really
shop.
Good restaurants.
And now we've got a local coffee roaster, good friends of ours. So all this stuff was happening on the square, and I think the decision to move back was rooted in that excitement that we could be a part of what was going on here and help shape and kind of help push Covington in a different direction with something that we wanted to do that maybe more on par with something that you would find in Atlanta or Austin or some of these places that we had traveled to and seen and loved, and wanted to bring that to our community. And it seemed like it was kind of an appropriate fit for the space and the story.
Well, I met you there at the City Pharmacy. The building has been in your family for a long, long time. I guess your dad worked there as a pharmacist. He used to swab the floors there. A beautiful original tile floor, by the way. So you and your wife decided to turn it into a restaurant. Had you ever worked in the restaurant business?
So my restaurant career ended when I was 18. I'd worked at the local pizza place here, washing dishes. And, I think that I got promoted to making salads just before I went off to school. So that was it for me.
So you thought, this is the business I want to be in? I've got all that experience washing dishes?
That's right. No. Well, I think we wouldn't be in the restaurant business if it wasn't for the space and the story. It was something that we had talked about. My siblings and I had joked around about it for the better part of the last 10 years. Wouldn't it be cool if we reopened City Pharmacy as a bar, you know, and play around with all the fun names that you could do? And,
oh, right, the cocktail names in themselves.
And shortly after I met my wife and we got engaged and had started looking to move to Covington, we were just very much in this transitional period. I was working for a business that was being sold, and we were just excited about what was going on here. And when we got the call that the tenant was moving out of this space, we just started sitting down and just writing down different ideas, and spent about 6 months just talking to different restaurateurs and people on the square that had started businesses. And about 6 months in, it was kind of the point of no return. We were in it, not knowing anything about the restaurant business. So,
well, you certainly picked it up. You got a great chef, Christian Perez, a female chef. You don't often find that, but that's a nice thing. You know, it strikes me, Tito, as I'm speaking to you, that your story reflects so many different things, you know, a transforming economy in a small town. You know, when the Walgreens and the Rite Aids moved in, the city pharmacy no longer holds the same space. And then for you, you know, growing up in that kind of town, thinking, I want to get away, and now coming back and saying, small towns, those communities, they're worth something, you know, whereas it used to be a place to leave. So have you seen other folks coming back to Covington, investing in that little town square?
Yeah, we've got several young couples that we knew growing up that have opened different retail shops here. I'd mentioned to you the coffee shop. It's full right now. And there was a time when I was riding my bike around the square and it was empty. And the complaint of the older generations now is that you can't find parking on the square. But I love it. You know, I love what's happening here and the direction that Covington's heading. But yes, we've very much seen a lot of people jumping in, going into business for themselves. My grandmother had a dress shop with my aunt across the street. My grandfather had a furniture store, two storefronts down from us. So it's fun to see all that kind of come back because I can vaguely remember, but through stories of my parents and grandparents about that time when all those shops were here. And it feels like it kind of went down for a bit, but has really come back in a new way.
Yeah, and your kids are going to be running around in that same city pharmacy building where you grew up.
Yeah, so I got my first haircut just in the back of the dining room here, and we'll have to carry on that tradition if my son ever grows hair. He's still trying to get there, but...
Well, Tito, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. I'm honored that you guys included me. So,
well, it's a great story and a great business, and that's Tito Stone. He's owner and partner at City Pharmacy. It's a restaurant in Covington, Georgia. And we'd like to know if you have a story about moving back home. Well, we would love to hear it. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can also write to us in our Facebook group or leave us a voicemail and a story at 404-500-9457. Well, it is, of course, runoff day in Georgia, but tomorrow we're going to be celebrating the anniversary of the repeal of Prohibition. We're going to mark the day with a master mixologist and get historic perspective from the Savannah Prohibition Museum. So you can hear on Second Thought live at 9 o'clock, or you can savor it on your own time, perhaps with an adult beverage later in the day. All right, back to runoff day. Voters are going to settle close races for the post of Secretary of State and a seat on the Public Service Commission. And GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler has been following it all, and he's with us again today. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning.
So turnout for runoff elections generally lower than in the general, as we know. Did that hold true for early voting for the runoff?
Well, so in the general election, 2.1 million Georgians cast their ballot early through mail-in ballots or in-person early voting. And last week for this election, only about 400,000 or so. So it's about a fifth of the turnout of the general election. But that turnout was actually higher than the primary election. So it's somewhere in between the primaries earlier this year and the general election in November.
All right. So comparing to Election Day here, any news yet on turnout from polling places so far?
Well, so far, we haven't seen the long lines that people mentioned and complained about or talked about in the November election. I know I waited 90 minutes to cast my ballot in the general election, and it looked like when I drove past my place this morning that I could have, if I was not here on the show, walked in and out no problem and cast my ballot. So it looks like we're not going to see the 2-3 hour lines in different places throughout Georgia, but there are people voting. So it's not nobody voting, but...
Any repeats of the other things that were reported on Election Day? Not the long lines necessarily, but broken machines or late opening of polling places.
Well, so far on social media and other things, we really haven't seen too many problems, but there are 159 counties in Georgia with 159 county elections officials and 159 different ways of, you know, disseminating things and getting things out. So if we do see problems throughout the day, it'll be in an extremely localized level, either at a precinct or maybe at a county thing, because this is run at a local level. Elections are run at a local level. So, you know, if somebody is sick with the flu and running late with the machines in the morning, then that's something that you can't really prepare for. But it's a local thing. And so far, things appear to be running smoothly.
Well, we know during the midterm elections, a lot of lawsuits. In fact, this has been one of the most litigated races in Georgia's history. Is that holding true for the runoffs? How have things been changed by court lawsuits?
If I had a dollar for every court filing that I've read over the past few months, I would be able to pay all of the fees to access those court documents. So what we've had is we've had a lot of different lawsuits basically touching every part of Georgia's election system, from the way voter registration is done all the way to how absentee ballots are cast and counted. Now, in the last week, there have been two different settlements for lawsuits that have affected the runoff. The first allows a wider range of people to serve as translators for people with limited English proficiency. Previously, the state law said it was only family, friends, or somebody who lives in your precinct, but the federal law says it can be anyone as long as it's not your boss or someone in your union. And the other settlement affects absentee ballots. Normally, the absentee ballots have to be received by today to be counted, but because of this settlement with Interim Secretary of State Robin Crittenden, if they're postmarked today and received by Friday, then they'll be counted. So there's about 100,000 or so mail-in ballots that have been sent out but not yet been returned. So more of those could be counted in this election.
So that's another huge change since the midterm elections. Interim Secretary of State Robin Crittenden is running things as Secretary of State. How she handled things differently?
Well, both of those lawsuits that I mentioned, those were settled, and those were settled pretty quickly and settled with what the people who filed the lawsuits had in mind. And there's some phrases in both of those that are just a stark difference from Governor-elect Brian Kemp and how he did things. Basically, these settlements happened because of, in the interest of time and expediency in the courts, instead of, you know, a multi-day court hearing and evidence and press releases and things like that, Interim Secretary of State Crittenden is saying, we agree with the law. You know, the settlements don't say we think we were wrong, but they're saying for the purposes of helping more people vote and for not dragging the state through the legal system and having this go for days and weeks and months, we're going to agree to the settlement for this election. And I mean, things are going to be changing with the elections with the next Secretary of State. So it's a different tone and tenor coming from that office in the last month.
How about Governor-elect Brian Kemp? Has his tone or tenor changed at all? He's going to be in a very different position now. Has he said anything at all about elections going forward or reforming?
Well, one thing that he has said is that he looks forward to working with the next Secretary of State, which he hopes is Republican Brad Raffensperger, or, you know, Democrat John Barrow if he wins, to enact some reforms. You know, he's not saying that everything the Democrats want is going to happen because he feels that elections are run a certain way and that they're run well, but he has the potential to really reform and overhaul elections and kind of have that be his legacy, which he entered office under a cloud of controversy over the election. So it's a really interesting position for him to be in, and we'll see next session how things change.
Stephen Fowler, he's GPB politics reporter, going to be monitoring tonight's runoff races. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, Stephen's posting results and analysis at gpbnews.org. And of course, you can keep store and check all day long at gpbnews.org. We will, of course, be covering the races. But that is it for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Tyler Morris engineered the show today. Don Smith is an editor, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. Again, we're on Facebook and on Twitter at OST Talk. Theme song by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back tomorrow with more on Second Thought.